This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. In 1885, Carl Benz constructed the first automobile. It had three wheels, like an invalid car, and ran on alcohol, like many drivers.
Since then, about 17 million people have been killed by them in an undeclared war.
And the whole of the rest of the world is in danger of being run over due to squabbles about their oil.
If an alien was to hover a few hundred yards above the planet, it could be forgiven for thinking that Kaz were the dominant life form,
and that human beings were a kind of ambulatory fuel cell, injected when the car wished to move off, and ejected when they were spent. Not one huckstering copywriter ever sees fit to mention that the automobile, even that moving pantheon, the Rolls, doubles your heartbeat on entry, and transforms your psychogalvanic skin response to set the needles shivering on any lie detector.
From the moment you settle comfortably behind the wheel, your pelvis fondled by replica flesh panting with static. It increases stress readings, slowly marinates the body of even the most experienced driver with adrenotoxins. Noisily generates a wide range of cardiovascular pressures, as well as doubling up as a dinky organ accumulator stimulating trash sexuality. Tides of blood and water in the body are magically mixed, as if there was a permanent full moon.
Oh, we had such an awful journey. I feel completely drained.
What did you want to talk to us about? My concentration's utterly shot.
Why did we come?
That was a quote from the long poem Autogeddon, written by British writer Heathcote Williams and originally published in 1987 in the fall edition of the Whole Earth Review. It was released as a lavishly illustrated book in 1991 and even made it into a radio drama by BBC Two. The presenter was Jeremy Irons, who, it turns out, loved cars. The background music was Gary Newman's 1979 song Cars. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to my hate affair with machines. Yes, I have lived without them. Millions of people still do, but like the Bushmen or the Neanderthals, they are pushed backward toward the distant fringes of our world, at least until the center collapses. Our entire lives have been carjacked, no doubt about it. We'll talk with Ann Lutz Fernandez, co-author of the book Carjacked, The Culture of the Automobile and Its Effect on Our Lives. My take? The car is a machine designed to suck the money and the life out of you. Really. In our second half hour, more machines direct the planet, air conditioners. Our guest is Stan Cox, author of Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World, and Finding New Ways to Get Through Summer. After the world roasted in 2010, with lots more to come, in the future greenhouse world, you might want to find out how to survive and keep your cool when the big machine breaks down.
The car is a beast that may well one day consume the earth and all who dwell on it. A terrifying thought. But what would the world be like with no internal combustion engine?
In The Story of Here Begins, I asked myself the question, setting aside the issues of the wide world for a second, who and what are right here under my nose? Well, from the top of Water Tower Hill, one answer is abundantly clear. My little 10-mile world is filled with cars. Lots and lots and lots. A God-king hell of a lot of cars. A large slice of the blame for centuries' worth of wrong turns can be laid at the feet of this one invention. More than any other single toy in the playroom of technology, it has enabled us to go completely crazy and to get there in air-conditioned comfort and style. That is a quote from Alan Wartz in his blog, The Story of Here, and it captures my own feelings so well When I venture outside to see the six-lane roadways that intersect near my home, those rivers of asphalt and steel, I risk my life if I try and run across them, and their exhaust penetrates my very walls and windows 24 hours a day. How did we get into this toxic way of life? I had to go and see a presentation by Catherine Lutz and Ann Lutz Fernandez for their new book, Carjacked, The Culture of the Automobile and Its Effect on Our Lives. My attempt to record that talk did fail, unfortunately, but we're lucky to have Ann on the phone with us now. Ann Lutz Fernandez, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, how is it that we love cars so much and hate the life that they impose on us?
Well, that's a nice way to express it, because when we started our research about 5 years ago, we tended to think just the former, that North Americans loved their vehicles and that it was truly a romance. But we discovered that the romance, which has been marketed to us over the decades and which we have grown up learning to love in part, through our family experiences and pleasant experiences growing up, family vacations and these positive things that we remember around the car, the day-to-day reality for most people is a little bit more fraught with contradiction. And we're finding that we're spending more time, money, and good health on our cars than we wish to.
And at the end of your presentation in Vancouver, I asked why you didn't go straight for the global warming impacts of car emissions. It seemed to me you said car culture is unsustainable and uneconomical, even without the whole emissions problem. Did I understand that correctly?
Absolutely. When we started the research for our book, we were feeling fairly hopeful that the message about the environmental impact of fossil fuels had been reaching a wider audience, and that there were a good number of folks who were responding to that by altering the way they moved around in the world. But we also found that no matter how much some Americans learned about the environmental impact of the automobile, many people felt really quite trapped by the built environment, felt that they had little choice. And we realized that there were some other arguments that we could make that might be more compelling on the household and immediate level, about how much cars are sucking funds out of our household budgets, out of our national budgets, how much time we're spending on a daily and weekly and annual basis in our cars as drivers or passengers, that there were a number of other avenues that we could explore to persuade people to really take a harder look at the cars that were parked in their driveways.
I know you talked about our personal attachment to cars. We may have done all sorts of things in them, and they really have been part of our life. We sort of go glassy-eyed thinking over our favorite car. But I think it's also a media problem. Our newspapers and the nightly news on TV, they absolutely depend on those car ads to survive. Maybe it's not surprising we know so little about the total car deaths and all those lives ruined by injuries. What did you find out about the connections between media and the car culture?
Well, absolutely, the automotive industry as a whole, and that includes the automakers, the suppliers of tires and other ancillary products, car insurance, as well as the dealerships on the local and regional levels, the spending that goes toward the media to advertise automotive products is just astounding. In the U.S., the auto industry has been year in and year out the number one advertiser. Local newspapers in particular tend to depend on the advertising they get for cars that are being sold either by individuals or by dealers. And so the messages that we're getting from the media tend to be the positive ones that reinforce the advertising messages that we're getting. We may get some advice on how to be a sharper buyer in the dealership, but we're not going to get many stories that really look at the realities of what it means to own two-plus cars, what that does to the household budget. We're not going to get a lot of stories about the year-in and year-out car fatalities and life-changing injuries that Americans are experiencing. We tend to get the glossy images repeated, perhaps with a sense of the insider's view on how to get a good deal, but other than that, we're not getting much hard-hitting news about car safety, about how cars perpetuate inequity, about some of the downsides of a car-dependent culture.
Well, right. I've been injured on the roads, and practically everybody I know has had an accident, and they can point to some injury they've had. And then there are all those people whose lives are just absolutely ruined one second. They're standing by the curb, or they're driving down the road, and everything's upside down with huge social costs, huge medical costs. Can you tell us more about that?
You know, we spoke to a wide variety of people who had experienced their own. You mentioned, you know, so many of us have had our own experiences being injured in a crash, or have a close friend or family member that we've lost to a highway or road crash. We had also spoken to a number of people who had killed or injured others in their vehicles, and those were some truly poignant stories of people who were continued to be haunted by the deaths that they felt responsible for. Folks who, you know, decades after a crash were still being cared for by their parents, for example, their aging parents taking care of them because they're confined to a wheelchair and still suffering the effects of a very severe crash. And we spoke to a number of those first responders, the police and the EMTs, who experience so often the repeated occurrence of a crash and see the lives in that moment that we so rarely see in the news, because they happen one at a time. You know, if there's a major plane crash or a train crash of any sort, we hear about it because multiple people were injured at the same time. But each day, those hundreds of people who are killed in crashes and the thousands who are injured largely go without our notice unless we have a personal connection to them.
And Anne, right outside my door, the same government that promises climate action is adding more lanes to the freeway. It's part of a binge of road construction that was shovel-ready when the government wanted to spend hundreds of billions in stimulus money. Did you look into the real costs of all these streets and highways?
Yes, absolutely. The externalized costs of our automobiles, you know, we looked at both the day-to-day household costs that people see, the finance costs, the gasoline costs, the insurance costs. And then there's that huge part of our tax bill that we don't fully understand where it's going. And some of that goes into road construction or maintenance. A lot of it goes to, you know, to our last point about the crashes. A tremendous amount of funds go into, obviously, traffic control and management and crash rescue and cleanup. A tremendous amount of our tax dollars still go to subsidies for the oil industry. You know, with the BP spill, there's been more attention paid to that, but the oil and auto industry for decades have been benefiting from tax dollars directly, that few people are aware of the total amount that's being siphoned from our tax coffers that the rest of us make up. You know, politically, it's been historically a positive thing for politicians to spend money on roads. If you or I own a car and we've put all of our hard-earned dollars into purchasing and maintaining that car, then we want roads to drive on. And in the United States, 9 out of 10 Americans do own cars and want good roads to drive them on. And so it's been a very politically easy way to spend money. We're fortunate, I think, to see some trending towards more public support for transit and shifting some of the dollars that have been spent on highways and roads towards transit and alternative, so-called alternative transportation. But it's been a long time coming, and it's a little bit slow getting there even now.
Take me riding in the car, car, take me riding in the car, car. Take you riding in the car, car, I'll take you riding in the car.
There's a ghost on the highway, and I want to run it down. There's a phantom in my bed, and I'm all alone now. There's no one I haven't had. Would you be there when the lights get shot right out? Would you be there when the roof comes crumbling down? And I know myself too well.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking about being carjacked by the car culture. With Ann Lutz Fernandez, I'm Alex Smith. As we've heard, with tough economic times, Americans are driving a little less and buying slightly fewer cars. The biggest market for cars is now China. And what are your impressions of car transport in China? Are they being carjacked as well?
Well, this is something that the media has been focusing on quite a bit over the last few years, which is the growth of individual transport in a country as big as China that's developing to the point where people can afford cars. And certainly we can look on with horror and think, oh my goodness, if we embraced car culture to the extent that we did as we became a more affluent continent, then what can we expect from China but more of the same? But I think it's a little bit of a distraction from our own continued reliance on automobiles to worry about what's going on overseas. It's a genuine concern, but we have, I think, a bit more control over our own behavior, and we have a lot more, in our view, a lot more opportunity to reduce our own automotive dependence here and provide perhaps a model that's a bit different than the model that we've already set for the developing world.
I can't agree more. I think America is the center of the dream, and that's where something should change. I do note, though, that one of the big auto builders in China is General Motors, which is owned by the government, and what are they building but great big Buicks that get not very good gas mileage, and that seems to be what's selling over there. Well, I'd like to get to another part of your book. It seems important that you show that the average consumer owning a car really doesn't pay. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, absolutely. If you take a look at the messages that we're getting from the media and from car advertising, then you come to believe that driving makes financial sense. In our research, we were surprised to find how focused people were about gas prices and worrying about gas prices, which are volatile and visible, but really only represent a tiny portion of what we spend on the automobile. You know, if you look at depreciation, insurance, maintenance, these costs dwarf gasoline. And for the average family in the United States, with our average two cars, we're spending about $14,000 U.S. out of our annual budgets to own and maintain those cars. There's, I think, a lack of financial literacy around car ownership, where we tend to think of the purchase price and then think, okay, it's paid for, and after that it's just gasoline. But the costs just keep on coming. We were surprised to discover how much of that purchase price is being paid for with automotive loans. More than 9 out of 10 of every car sold in the United States is sold on credit, and almost the entire purchase price, other than a very small down payment, is being paid for with loans. And many of the loans are at rates that are higher than you might expect. So when we look at the credit crisis that we've undergone over these last couple of years, a large portion of that can be attributed to auto loans. And that's, I think, an underreported story about car dependence, is that it really becomes a credit dependence. And we're being sold increasingly expensive automobiles. Over the past couple of decades, the average price of the American car has increased by double digits, almost 25% in inflation-controlled dollars. And while you would think that cars would be getting cheaper as we, you know, get better at producing them, because they're packed with so much luxury, because they're packed with so much horsepower, so much technology these days, the automakers are charging more and more, and we're borrowing more and more to be able to purchase the latest and best new vehicles.
Yeah, for a while GM was making much more from their finance arm than they were from selling cars, so we can see that's a big one. You also talked about the socioeconomic aspect of this, like what happens for the poorer people and the working poor?
Yes, I think there's an awareness that to be without a car in a car-dependent culture is a tremendous obstacle to opportunity. If you live in a city and most of the jobs that are being created in the suburban ring and you don't have a car, then you're going to be hard-pressed to even get an interview, much less be able to secure and keep a job. But what we discovered is that the working poor who are able to afford their cars are perhaps in a worse situation, only because they're working so hard to stay in those cars. We talked to a number of people who were just one fender bender or one parking ticket away from losing their vehicle, and of course then losing the job that they need just to continue to keep that vehicle. So there's a real catch-22 in terms of, for many working families, working hard to earn the money to keep the car that can get them to work. So whereas I think going into this, certainly I saw the car as, you know, a way out, right? That you need a car to get out of poverty, to get a job, to perhaps rise up the socioeconomic ladder. We achieved an understanding that, in fact, for a large swath of the population, the car was, in fact, perhaps the opposite of the route to opportunity, but something that was weighing down a large number of families.
And then we've got the problems of public health when it comes to smog, and also people getting just the lack of exercise that helps many people get obese. So can you talk a little bit about the health impacts of this culture?
A number of diseases that we hear about frequently as growing problems in North America, asthma, other lung diseases, obesity, as you mentioned. While we can't place all of the blame for the growth in these diseases at the feet of the automobile, we can attribute quite a large percentage of them, perhaps half of diseases of the lung, heart attack, stroke. These are diseases which rates are much higher as a result of the fact that we are driving more, breathing in the air, both that's coming out of the tailpipe, but also in terms of many of the components of the interior of the automobile. Although there have been some changes made by some manufacturers, there's still off-gassing of chemicals from components inside the car that are causing health problems. Folks that live near highways have higher rates of many of these pollution-related diseases. And then, again, just simply sitting in the car, even if you weren't breathing, you're not walking, you're not active, and it's one more contributor to the obesity problem that, again, turns into other diseases like diabetes.
This is Radio EcoShock, talking with Ann Lutz Fernandez, co-author of the new book, Carjacked, The Culture of the Automobile and Its Effect on Our Lives. And all interviews must end with feel-good solutions, ways out of this mess. I'm going to be brutally frank. I think car madness and trucking will drive the economy and the environment right off the cliff before there is much change. We may drive until we drop. Truthfully, are you more hopeful than that?
I am, and in fact, the trip that took me out to Vancouver, and my sister and I took a train trip across the country, and we stopped in various cities, Chicago, Milwaukee, Portland, Seattle, and ended our trip in Vancouver. And all along the way, we met a wide variety of individuals and groups that are working to, in some cases, mitigate the negative effects of car culture, and in other cases, to provide really strong positive alternatives. And I think we're much more optimistic about the chances for transportation alternatives to provide attractive social identities, something that we see around car culture is this notion that, you know, if I own the right car, I can express myself. Well, people in the biking communities in various cities are building very appealing social identities around these alternatives. We see the younger generation less quick to become car owners and less quick to become licensed drivers. And we see that as a shift in generational attitude towards the environment, but also towards the car and how you can connect with other people. Younger people are using social media to connect. They don't need to hop in the car and drive away to get away from their parents and hook up with their friends. They can do that in a variety of other ways. So we are seeing some positive trends generationally. It may be that, you know, as those of us who are a bit older get older, we find too that we're not as eager to find ourselves situated in communities that keep us dependent on the car, and start looking for more walkable, transit-oriented communities in which to retire. So we see that as a positive trend as well. But it is a battle, and one that we think, with drawing attention to the ease and comfort and positive aspects of other alternatives and building some financial literacy around household transportation costs and alternatives, we can see our way out of what seems like an overwhelming cultural barrier.
And I have to say, your last chapter is called A Call to Action, and I like the fact that you don't over-intellectualize about a car-free utopia. Instead, you've got a lot of steps we can try starting from where we are right now. Well, folks, I've more or less given up driving except for my once-a-year vacation. Catherine and Anne did their cross-continental book tour without stepping into a car. I'm hoping our interview and this fine new book will convince you that car culture is a dying way of life. Check out the book Carjacked and find out more at carjacked.org. Thank you, Anne Lutz Fernandez, for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I'm your host, Alex Smith. Find this interview as a free MP3 on the transportation page of our audio-on-demand menu at ecoshock.org.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
The Death Toll, a reading from Carjacked by Ann Lutz Fernandez and Catherine Lutz. Catherine, by the way, is an anthropologist, author, and professor at Brown University. Quote, "As a nation, we are nearly three times more likely to be killed in a car crash than by homicide, and our children face no greater risk of dying from any cause, accidental or disease-related. If we die at work, it is usually in a vehicle. Since records started being kept in 1992, crashes are the number one killer on the job, with professional drivers, salespeople, and farmers especially vulnerable. Most people are shocked when they hear the annual highway death toll in the United States, 41,059 people killed in car crashes in 2007, or an average of 112 people a day, the equivalent of a nearly fully loaded passenger plane going down in flames every single day of the year." Safety advocates often use this analogy, both because it suggests how distorted our perceptions of risk can be. Far more people fear getting on planes than into their autos, and because it suggests at least one of the reasons why the car deaths happen one by one with regularity, like the drip from a broken faucet. But typically, because the 112 Americans and the 3,300 people worldwide who were killed by cars yesterday or the 112 the day before that didn't die together all at once, they didn't make the news. End quote from the book Carjacked. In Wikipedia, it says, it is estimated in 2004 that 1.2 million people were killed, 2.2% of all deaths, and 50 million more were injured in motor vehicle collisions. Think about that, 50 million people a year. This makes motor vehicle collisions the leading cause of death among children worldwide aged 10 to 19 years old. 260,000 children a year die, 10 million are injured, and often in countries with little or no health care, and I might include the United States in that. And the sixth leading preventable cause of death in the United States is motor vehicle accidents. In Canada, they are the cause of 48% of all severe injuries. We can note that most of the deaths and injuries are now occurring among the poorest people in the world as roads designed for horses and oxen are badly converted for trucks, motorbikes, and cars. Pedestrians and cyclists are mowed down with alarming regularity in China, India, Sri Lanka, and Kazakhstan, all over the world. 49% of countries have no seatbelt laws and no maximum for alcohol when you're driving. In Holland, where cyclists and pedestrians have their own paths, and mass transit really works, your odds of dying in a vehicle accident are 1 in 135. In the United States, that shrinks to 1 in 54. Just imagine, if you will, if bodies were not whisked away from deadly intersections, never hidden from TV cameras. They would pile up with feet and heads collecting in the gutters. If ghosts lingered and shouted from their roadside graves, who could bear to drive again? All that to get a pop from the corner store, have a little fun, get a burger from the drive-thru, to get some time at the office or the daycare. It has been many Vietnam Wars, several Holocausts, a Black Death in our times. Remember the Stockholm Syndrome, though. We learn to love our captors, even our executioners. How exciting to buy a new car. How exciting to die in it. The willing victims limp into their next vehicle. What can you do? We must drive ourselves to the very end. I love my car. Here is Roger Taylor of Queen.
I'm in love with my car. I feel for my automobile. Get a grip on my boiling swimming bar. Such a thrill when you're waiting to squeal. Told my girl I'd have to forget her. Buy me a new Cabriolet.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
First, I told myself it was nothing but a nightmare, that I'd wake up and find it had all been nothing but a weird dream that never really happened. But it's not a dream, and no one will believe my story, not even you.
It's such an irrational story. How can you expect anyone to believe it?
We know it's probably bad for us, but we just can't stop doing it. I'm not talking about drugs or your diet, but air conditioning. Author Stan Cox explains how refrigerated rooms and offices have transformed America and the world at a very high price for our planet and our culture. His new book is Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Air-Conditioned Worlds, and of Finding New Ways to Get Through Summer. I'm Alex Smith, your host. Stan Cox, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good to be with you.
Stan, your previous book was Sick Planet, Corporate Food and Medicine. What caused you to move on to your investigation of air conditioning?
Well, I was struck by, when I looked into it, the amount of resources that go into air conditioning, the greenhouse emissions and other problems that are generated. And when we think about the other big energy guzzlers in our society, the automobile, jet aircraft, television, computer, we've had a lot of debate about the pros and cons of those. They've been widely discussed, but all the time air conditioning has kind of been humming away in the background and I believe has had just as profound an effect on our society.
I was surprised how deep and rich this book is. I read it all because you don't stop with the technology, but you get into a lot of underlying social assumptions. For example, most of us were raised with the idea that hot weather makes people move slower, and that's why the U.S. Northeast leapt ahead into industrialization, while the South and at least most southern developing nations lagged behind. Talk to us about that, would you?
Yeah, there was a long tradition in the first half of the 20th century of researchers purporting to demonstrate that the warmer the weather, the lower the level of economic growth, the less productivity, et cetera. And there was a good statistical evidence for that. But of course, when you're comparing, say, between different countries, a lot of tropical countries have a history of imperialism, colonialism, et cetera. There are a lot of other reasons that some countries are rich and others poor. But there were analysts still as late as the 1940s saying that the main reason the South had not, southern United States had not developed was because of the high annual average temperature. And sure enough, in the age of air conditioning, the past 50 years, 70% of our economic growth has been in the South. Coincidence or not, that change occurred as air conditioning was taking off. I don't think it's necessarily an effect of people feeling more comfortable and therefore producing more, but it made it possible for a lot of industries to move to the South. We wouldn't have the world's largest and seventh largest airports in Atlanta and Dallas if it weren't for that. The Research Triangle of North Carolina without air conditioning wouldn't be a hub for pharmaceuticals, computing, etc.
Until very lately, the American South has been growing not just in jobs but in population. As you describe very well in your book, if we had to turn off the air conditioners, I wonder, there could be a giant exodus and migration back north, and that could happen if dwindling fossil fuels become too expensive or climate change just overwhelms our power supplies, leading to blackouts. Do you find in your study what happens when refrigerated people have the machine shut down for some reason? Does crime go up? Could society become more unstable?
Well, that's a good question. I start the book out in Phoenix, which is probably the city more than any other in this country or maybe the world created by air conditioning. There would not be 5 million people living in the area in that valley if it weren't for air conditioning. And it, certainly if there were some, through some series of events, there were no air conditioning available, people would, that migration that's been going on for 50 years into the Phoenix area would stop. But there are other forces that will do the same thing. As I talk about, the air conditioning has made it possible for many more people to move into that area and some other areas of the country than there is water available to support them. So it's been predicted for a long time that eventually Phoenix is going to not have sufficient water. On the other hand, the 50-year exodus into Phoenix and into South Florida, which I also go into in some detail, about a year and a half ago, suddenly stopped. Of course, the reason was the big economic decline, and people just generally stopped relocating. But there are even signs now that that migration is reversed, that people are deciding with or without air conditioning that those are not necessarily the best places to live and are leaving.
You know, I guess air conditioning is stalling public awareness of global warming, and many of us think, well, if it gets too hot, I'll just add more air conditioning. What's the matter with that logic?
Well, I kind of see that as the central irony of this whole issue and sort of the mascot for the book, I guess, the fact that as we continue to put out increased amounts of greenhouse emissions and we see hotter summers, and we know now that this very hot summer of 2010 was the culmination of the hottest decade ever recorded. If that trend continues and our response is we can deal with it with air conditioning, what we're doing, of course, is helping to ensure that there will be even hotter summers, more frequent and intense heat waves in the future, and we'll need even more air conditioning. Right now, the greenhouse emissions from air conditioning buildings and vehicles in this country amounts to almost 500 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent each year, which makes it if that were a country, it would be one of the major carbon emitters in the world. So it's a cycle that I see as needing to be broken.
I'd like to focus for a minute on car air conditioning. Is that just an American fixation?
Well, it got its start in America, of course, and we very rapidly have adopted it, and it's pretty much universal now. You're hardly going to find a new car for sale in America that doesn't have it. But in recent years, it's really taken over in other parts of the world, whereas a decade ago, very few European cars were equipped with air conditioning as standard equipment. Within a few years, they're saying that 95% of European cars will have air, and that has already, the increase in use of mobile air conditioning in Europe, both through increased fuel consumption and through leakage of refrigerants, has been fingered as the primary culprit in the European Union's failure to fulfill its Kyoto Protocol goals for reducing emissions.
I have lived in the American South, and I did manage to do so without car air conditioning, but I can certainly understand why people have it. So what can people do, if they must have it, to reduce the impact of car air conditioning?
Well, I guess we have to look at the vehicle air conditioning in particular as more of a systemic problem, because you're right, I've also lived in the South and in very hot climates, and because of the way we've built our cities and because of our dependence on the automobile, it would be very difficult for people to get to work and back, especially in cities like Atlanta, L.A., or Miami that have often very long commutes without air conditioning. So air conditioning obviously adds to fuel consumption, but the best way to cut our overall emissions from driving is, of course, to drive as little as possible to carpool or whatever is required to simply not be driving as much. And you know, that's not very feasible for a lot of people. So the long-term goal needs to be a complete overhaul of our transportation system, more convenient, affordable mass transit, more relocation of homes and businesses so there you can have more pedestrian, bicycle, etc. Traffic. So air conditioning adds to a problem that is already so huge that we need to figure out a different way to do things.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking about Losing Our Cool, a new book on air conditioning and its alternatives from author Stan Cox. Stan, I looked into the gigantic costs of cooling office towers, all those buildings where floor-to-ceiling windows can never be opened, even when it's nice outside. In Toronto, Canada, the AC costs were so high, a series of downtown towers tried an expensive scheme to pump cold water from Lake Ontario around. Tell us about the problems of commercial air conditioning and whether you think some buildings may have to be abandoned simply because they're so inefficient.
Well, in the age of air conditioning, of course, buildings have been built in a very different way. The cross-ventilated designs that might have been in an E or an H shape in the past, you don't see that anymore. You don't see a case where everyone in an office is close enough to a window to get some ventilation. And as you say, often the windows don't even open. Once we commit to air conditioning like that, then it's a matter of trying to make the building as tight, energy efficient as possible, not only in the winter, but all year round. That has been shown to result in increased incidence of sick building syndrome, that is, the buildup of air pollutants that causes a number of health problems for people. There have been studies in the U.S., Brazil, Europe, other places, all showing that people who work in air-conditioned buildings go to the doctor in the hospital more and have more frequent health problems than people who don't live with, don't work in an air-conditioned environment. So you're right that the deep space within big office blocks could become uninhabitable without air conditioning, but in the meantime, it'll take a long time to revamp our infrastructure, but in the meantime, there are things that can be done. The most common comment that I've heard since this book came out and the most common complaint of office employees in surveys is that it's too cold in their office in the summer, and they'll often say, I have to take a sweater or a space heater to work. That's obviously something that could be addressed right away is the excessive use of air conditioning. While we try to encourage the green building movement, natural cooling, passive cooling movement for buildings of the future.
Is there a link between AC and consumer spending in malls?
Well, we do know that in a very brief period from 1995 to 2003, the amount of air conditioning used for cooling malls, both enclosed and strip malls in the U.S., increased by 77%. That's not just that more malls were being built, because the amount of cooling per square foot in malls increased 34% just in those 8 years. Now, that ran up to just before the big bust, and so a lot of retail space has gone vacant right now, so we've probably seen some reduction. But there is the general, and has been since air conditioning was invented, the general feeling that cooling off customers tends to stimulate them to buy more. There was a kind of a funny article in the New York Times in around 2005 in which the reporter took a thermometer into various stores in Manhattan, and the more upscale the store, the cooler the environment, and it got down in the most high-class stores, it was down to 68 degrees Fahrenheit. And the reporter, when they asked the managers there, they said, oh, yes, absolutely, it's part of the upscale image is to have the space very cool. During the recent I was on a couple of radio programs in New York during the heat wave in early July, and there were a lot of complaints about retail outlets in Manhattan running the air conditioning full blast with the doors open to try to attract people inside.
Well, the more we cool the inside, the more the outside heats up. I can envision a dystopia where humans can't live outside without mechanically cooled body suits. Stan Cox, we need to talk about how to get off this spiral, the other options for living comfortably. What are some of the strategies you cover in your book, Losing Our Cool?
Well, one thing I try to address is this question of efficiency. Should you go out and buy a more efficient air conditioner? And that efficiency alone is not going to be the answer. We, in a recent 12-year period in which the efficiency of home air conditioning equipment in this country improved by 28%, during that same time, the amount of energy used to cool the average air-conditioned home went up 37%. So people are obviously taking advantage of that greater cooling power per dollar that they were getting. So rather than looking to improve your efficiency by 20-25% with new equipment, there are ways to look for in which you could cut the consumption of air conditioning electricity in the home much more than that simply by not using it as much. There's a tendency just to keep the air conditioning running in, say, here in the Midwest or in the South from April to October, right through a lot of periods that are not life-threatening heat waves. They're just normal hot summer weather, and a time when you can be indoors out of the sun with a fan going, with a breeze perhaps coming through the window. The indoors will often be 10 degrees below the outdoor, the maximum temperature outdoors for that day, and it's not bad at all. People also, of course, who have basements, when it really does get hot, the basement is a good place to go. There are a lot of more futuristic, or some of them borrow from very old technology, things like cooling towers that I discuss in the book. There's solar, purely solar air conditioning that uses the heat of the sun to produce chilled water, and a number of other techniques, ground source cooling, in which the refrigerant is pumped deep into the earth to release the heat out of the house or office. Those technologies will also help us to reduce energy consumption from air conditioning. But overall, we're, I think, going to be healthier and happier if we just simply don't use it as much.
As we wrap up, is there something we missed or a final message you would like to leave with our listeners?
I think one thing that we have to focus on is the thing to adjust isn't necessarily the thermostat. It may be adjustment of our own expectations of comfort. There is, among comfort researchers, what has come to be known as adaptive model of comfort, which says the range of temperatures that you find to be comfortable isn't necessarily a fixed range, this many degrees to this many, but it moves. It changes depending on the kinds of temperatures you've been exposed to in recent days and weeks and how much you've acclimatized. Medical research has shown as well that the body is very good at acclimatizing to heat, but of course, to do that, we can't be living in a tightly controlled cool temperature all the time. It does reduce our heat tolerance. So I think that's the message I'd like to leave people with, is think about how we can adjust ourselves perhaps to a warmer world of the future, and maybe use our own resilience and not rely so much on expensive and often fragile technology.
Well, thank you so much. We have been talking with Stan Cox. He's the author of Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World, and Finding New Ways to Get Through Summer. You can find out more at his website, losingourcool.com, and download a free MP3 copy of this Radio EcoShock interview from the Climate Change page of our Audio On Demand menu. That's at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The book Losing Our Cool by Stan Cox is packed full of useful statistics and facts, and they lead to some deep insights about our society. Various academics, including Dr. Lisa Guan of Queensland University in Australia, calculate air conditioners in office buildings would collapse during unusual heat waves, like the 14 degrees above normal that just hit Moscow. Cox tells us air conditioners raise the surrounding air temperatures outdoors by up to 10 degrees, adding to the giant heat island effect in cities. That demands even more air conditioning in a positive feedback loop. Quoting from the book, in 2008, analysts at Hamburg University of Technology in Germany considered the geographical distribution of cooling and heating requirements under two climate change scenarios, along with the distribution of human population across the globe, and they compared those with the current distribution of climates and population. From this, they projected changes in humanity's heating and cooling demands. 4 decades from now, they concluded, the average citizen of Earth will experience 18 to 25% less cold weather and 17 to 23% more hot weather each year. Because populations are growing faster in warm regions of the planet, and all regions will become warmer. Taking population growth into account, cooling demand will increase by 65 to 72%. Even though the majority of people now living in the world's hottest climates cannot afford air conditioning now, and probably still won't have access to it in 2050, millions of homes, offices, other buildings, office buildings, and vehicles on every continent will be newly air-conditioned or be reinforced with beefed-up cooling systems. That will add to energy demand and put great stress on global efforts to cultivate sources of energy that will not further worsen global warming. In this arena, the United States is the undisputed champion. Already, air conditioning is approaching 20% of year-round electricity consumption by American homes, the highest percentage in our history. In the commercial sector, it uses 13%. Air conditioning by homes, businesses, public buildings together was consuming a total of 484 billion kilowatt hours per year in 2007. Compare this to 1955, when I was born, into Georgia's late August heat. That year, the nation consumed a total of 497 billion kilowatt hours for all uses, not just air conditioning. We use as much electricity for air conditioning now as is currently consumed for all purposes by all 930 million residents of the continent of Africa. End quote. So, we in America use as much for air conditioning as everybody in Africa uses for all purposes. Stan Cox figures we'll need trillions more kilowatt hours if people in China, India, and Brazil start consuming as much air conditioning power as Americans. And they are already living in a hotter place. Most of that would come from coal. You can see it. Just like in the movie Brazil, the outside gets hot and dead as coal-fired plants churn out more megawatts. Humans must live inside buildings of cooling pipes or die. That is where we're headed if you and I decide we can turn air conditioning as our way of coping with global warming. There are lots of better options. Most humans lived without air conditioning, and the majority still do. Houses were built to cool us, just as termite mounds do. As Stan suggests, we can adapt ourselves personally to greater heat. And forget the office dress code. No more ties and jacket. Welcome shorts and sandals. make windows that open, use fans if we must, cool the person, not the whole damn 5,000-square-foot house.
All that is about to end.
Let me interject one observation about we humans. There are actually two races of humans, the furnace people and the lizard people. Furnace people generate their own heat deep from within their cores, and they feel hot even in cool weather. Lizard people get their heat externally and can fry happily on a rock in the Arizona sun. Generally, trying to seek balance in their opposites, furnace people do meet and marry lizard people. They can never be comfortable in the same room. My humble suggestion, try to find a mate who meets your heat type. If possible, furnace people should move to the coasts or further north. Seriously, find a microclimate that makes you feel comfortable without intervention by machines, and choose a home that can keep its cool. Power will go out during heat waves. Also, try to learn the difference between heat stroke and mere surrender to heat. If you are vulnerable to medical emergency, or perhaps you're a senior, find that shade, go for the basement, or at least run a cool bathtub of water and climb in. For the rest of us, some of my happiest moments, as a lizard person, consist of being knocked down into a hammock or a bed by the heat, waiting it out with no inclination to move at all beyond sipping drinks. Fear of heat just makes you hotter. I've lived in Bradenton, Florida year-round with no air conditioner. I've camped in southern Arizona without one. Same thing on my visit to Trivandrum in equatorial India. You get work done early in the day and late in the evening, with a siesta period in the hottest hours. You learn to totally relax without fear of the heat. You learn to adapt. And we can live and listen to the real world beyond the hum of machines. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Be sure and visit our website at ecoshock.org for all sorts of free downloads. You can also sign up to this broadcast through a podcast at our website. Check out our blog at ecoshock.info. We're about to hear my good friend from Oakland, California, Dana Pearson, with just a snippet of his original songwriting, Science is the Answer.
Religion's not good. Everything's discovered.